We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it? I think this is a very hard choice, but the price, we think the price is worth it.
Hello, everybody. I want to welcome you to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. This is your host, Mance Rader. This is episode 103. It's going up on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, eBooks, YouTube, on my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com, and on libertarianinstitute.org in the blog section. Well, I've been talking about my new book for some time now, and I really haven't given any description on it. I think I have on a couple of interview podcasts, but I haven't really talked about it here. Well, this is Saturday evening, April 21st. On April 19th, the book dropped on Amazon in paperback and in Kindle version. The book is called The Kids Are Not All Right, a meme-enhanced primer on encroaching Marxism in the West. Dave Smith of the Part of the Problem podcast and a great comedian, funny guy. If you have not seen his special Libertas, go download it off of iTunes, download it off of Gas Digital's website. It is just an hour of libertarian, anarcho-capitalist humor, and it is truly funny. So go check that out. So Dave provided the foreword for this, and there's a couple blurbs on the back cover. One is by Jeff Deist, president of the Mises Institute, former chief of staff for Ron Paul, and Scott Horton, who you've heard on my podcast numerous times, the number one foreign policy expert in the world right now, as far as I'm concerned, director of libertarianinstitute.org, editor at antiwar.com. The book is jumped right out of the gate on Amazon in three different categories. It was the number one new release. It was number one new release in anarchism. It was number one new release in libertarianism. And I trolled some commies and socialists by getting it to be the number one new release in the communism and socialism section. So go to Amazon, search my name, Mance Rader, search The Kids Are Not All Right. But if you search Mance Rader, you'll see my first book there, Freedom Through Memedom, which you always hear me talk about. And now you'll hear me talk about this book, The Kids Are Not All Right. It is it basically looks at the culture of the college campus, the culture of Antifa, the culture of what the professors on the college campuses are teaching, and how that's translating into the real world, into international corporations. It's a truly remarkable time. Somebody on Facebook said, "Did you really write a book about the Red Scare?" And that's not what this is about. It's about what it's doing to the culture. You can get thrown in jail in Canada for misgendering somebody. Someone's going to jail in Scotland for teaching his pug how to Sieg Heil. What this book is about, it's about the culture that caused that in Europe, where people can get arrested for doing something stupid with a dog, that people can get arrested in Canada for misgendering somebody, and how that is coming here. And I give numerous examples of how it's already here, and I give you suggestions on how to combat it. If you know me at all from my Twitter profile, I post a lot of memes. If you have my first book, you know that I love memes. I think they're a great communication device. And I did the same thing with this one, except I separated into chapters, and you have a meme and you have a commentary by me. So check this out. Go look at it on Amazon. It's already in the top 10. It's already top 10 selling in the category of anarchism and the category of libertarianism and communism and socialism. So, check it out. And I'll be talking about it a lot. The second announcement I wanted to make is that I already talked about Dave Smith. If you listen to the Part of the Problem podcast, you know that he's remarkable. If you ever catch any of his appearances on Headline News, on SE Cup Unfiltered, you know that he just does a great job of just smacking people down who, the rampant pro-war, the pro-statism, just this past week, somebody who was talking about how, using the Nuremberg defense, saying that police officers in New York had stepped over the line, but don't blame them. Like I said, the Nuremberg defense. Well, I'm going to be on Dave's show, Part of the Problem, this coming Monday, April 23rd. It appears live on Gas Digital, on the part of the problem section of Gas Digital, at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you can't tune in, now if you tune in on there, you'll be able to see me. It's an actual video. You know, he and I will be going back and forth on Skype, and you'll be able to see us having our discussion, and we'll be talking about this book. And the first time I appeared on his show, we talked about the book, but we talked about a whole bunch of other anarchy-related subjects, libertarian-related subjects. So, I'm looking forward to this. And like I said, if you can't watch it, if you can't see it live, Dave always puts up his podcasts, usually around 3 p.m. His Monday podcast goes up on YouTube on Tuesday at 3 p.m. And then a couple hours later, it'll be on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, all of those places that you can check it out. So, and on their website, Gas Digital. So check that out. It's going to be a lot of fun. So getting the book ready and releasing it and then just basically doing all sorts of publicity on the internet, I haven't had a chance to really sit down and record a podcast. I'm recording a podcast tomorrow night that I'll release probably, I'll probably release maybe Wednesday, maybe even earlier. And, that one we'll be talking about this past week was the 25th anniversary of day 51, the assault on Waco, the assault on Mount Carmel. And I'll be talking with tomorrow James Bovard, who for years has written articles about how Waco, the actions of that day affected policing and federal policing. And also, I mean, he goes deep. So we're going to have a short talk tomorrow night and I'll release it. I think you'll really enjoy it. But what I'm going to do tonight is, I don't know if a lot of you have heard this, but like I said previous, I have been on Dave Smith's Part of the Problem podcast before. So I have a copy of it. I'm sure a bunch of you have not heard it. And this was me promoting my first book, Freedom Through Memedom, The 31-Day Guide to Waking Up to Liberty. And he loved the book. He said he read it pretty much in one sitting. We talk about the book, and then we just talk about a bunch of other stuff. I mean, we just fly all over the place on a bunch of subjects. So we'll use this as a preview to Monday's podcast. You'll see what we've talked about previous. And I'm sure we're going to talk a lot about my book and talk a lot about communism and socialism and even get into some current events on Monday. So people, enjoy this. This was a great time. And I look forward to having a great time on Monday night again with Dave. So here is my previous appearance on Dave Smith's Part of the Problem.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to a brand new episode of Part of the Problem, back in the Gas Digital Studios, where I belong. My home away from home. I'm very excited for this episode. We got a fantastic guest with us. I'm so happy that he took the time. He is the host of the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast, and he is the author of this great book, Freedom Through Memedom. Guys, Mance Rader, how are you, sir? Thanks for taking your time.
Thank you for having me. Thank you. Love your show.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I've been getting, you know, in this weird Twitter internet world that we live in, I've gotten a bunch of comments from people who are like, you got to have this guy on the show. You guys would have a great conversation. I kept hearing the name over and over again. I saw your Twitter handle is MN Rothbard, which wins a lot of points with me. And then just recently you sent me a copy of the book, which I read in one sitting. I thought it was just fantastic. So I want to talk a whole bunch about yourself and how you got into this, and then we'll talk a bunch about the book. So where to begin? You are, we have, some things in common. You are a New Yorker, as am I. You were born here, correct?
Bronx, born and bred.
All right. And you also, were converted, for lack of better term, into this liberty world, in 2007 by Ron Paul, which of course is, people who listen to the show know is my path as well. So let me ask you, before 2007, before you found this libertarian thing, were you interested in politics before that? Were you a conservative, a liberal?
I would say that socially liberal, everything else conservative.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, it's hard to be from the Bronx and be socially conservative. There's not too many of them up there.
No, it's well, by the time the Ron Paul movement came around, I had been out of the Bronx for 20 years. So, okay. I lived in Florida for a long time, longer than I lived in the Bronx. So, I bounced around a little bit, and, when when the debates in 2007 hit, I was like, this guy has unbelievable balls to say what he's saying. And it's stuff that I have thought, but it wasn't anything that I had put together. It wasn't anything that in my mind I was like, yes, that's why this is happening. That's why all this is happening. And as soon as that debate was over, I was just like, yeah, this guy's on the right track. And I ordered the book he had at the time that was a bunch of his speeches from the House floor, A Foreign Policy of Freedom. I read that in a couple days, and I was hooked from there. Then I discovered Mises and started getting all the books, started reading Rothbard, started reading Lou Rockwell, Mises, of course, Hayek. And from there, it was a jump.
Yeah, man. And what a crazy world we live in. I just saw when you tweeted that you were going on the show in a few minutes, and I saw Jeff Dice, the president of the Mises Institute, liked the tweet. And those little things are the things that still get to me. They're still like, that's so great. The president of the greatest institute in the world is favoriting our podcast.
Well, I was drunk and a little bit of something else one night, and I put out a video of a song, and I had tagged Scott Horton in it because I knew, because it was a song that he uses in his intro, and Jeff Dice immediately jumped in and he's like, man, I still have the cassette. So yeah, I mean, Twitter just brings people together, that's for sure.
Yeah, it is a weird. It brings people together, and it seems to be our only hope. So very surprisingly, it still seems to be up even after net neutrality was repealed the other week. I'm shocked we're able to have this conversation. But yeah, it's a weird thing, this internet game, because it does. It's a weapon that is kind of like really our only chance. Our only chance against the state is to have this tool. But at the same time, it also seems to give some. A platform to some of the more ridiculous voices out there across the spectrum.
If some of those ridiculous voices weren't on Twitter, it wouldn't be as fun.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. That certainly is. So what did you – okay, so you were kind of, you know, a socially liberal but then conservative on other things. That's were you conservative on the war issue? Because this is the issue that Ron Paul kind of, you know, spoke to both of us on.
In the beginning – you know, after 9/11, I had questions about – I had some conspiratorial questions, but you know, when it came right down to it, I bought into, okay, you know, if they have bases in Afghanistan, do that and everything. But I quickly abandoned all of that once I saw exactly what was going on. Started hearing things from people that I had met in the military who had come back. You know, it's amazing how many people you meet who are former military, who are now, you know, anarchists and libertarians, voluntarists. And I just, by the time Ron Paul came around, I had just I had stopped thinking about the war. I mean, it was just something that, let's see, Iraq was, what, 4 years old at that point? Afghanistan was 6 years old at that point. You know, I'm trying to have a life. I'm trying to, you know, right around that time too, I got married, and it was just all this stuff was going on. And I heard, man, when I heard what he said, you know, he said they attack us because we're over there. I was like, yeah, that makes sense to me. If someone broke into my house, I'm going to kill them.
Right.
And so, you know, to this day, I see people talking about, you know, how violent, you know, if we weren't over there, they'd be killing each other. And I'm like, and?
Right.
And what does that have to do with you? Well, the stability in the Middle East. I'm like, we have oil. We can get oil from, we have our own oil. We get oil from Russia. We can get oil from everywhere. It's like, why do we have to, you know, just because we have this relationship since, you know, the 30s with Saudi Arabia. I mean, what we can do without them. You know, but if they're, you know, still will be my favorite till this day. If we don't fight them over there, we're going to fight them over here. Oh, my God. I want to smack. I wanted to smack people who said that, because even the first time I heard that, and I was, you know, and I still may have been, you know, for what they were doing, that never made any sense to me. It wasn't logical to me.
So. Yeah, well, that's one of the things, and we're going to get into the book, but one of the things that you're really great at doing is just poking holes in the ridiculous inconsistencies in some of this logic. But it really is quite an amazing thing, the war on terror. I mean, if you wanted to, you know, kind of, and I'm not the first to make this comparison, but kind of like the war on drugs, I mean, if you were looking for a war that you can guarantee will never end, what a great one to have. I mean, the war on terror. So we go to war, and the goal is to, you know, eliminate terrorism. And then, of course, every time there's an act of war, an act of terrorism here, that's proof that we need more of this war on terror. So they've got this circular logic where you're guaranteed it will never end.
Well, and every time there's an act after 9/11, say Pulse nightclub, San Bernardino, well, why did they say this happened? They're all, it's every excuse, every time it comes up, it's always blowback.
Mm-hmm. You
know?
Yeah.
I mean,
And one of the great points Scott Horton always mentions, and, you know, that I borrow from him, as I do from a lot of these great guys in the libertarian movement. But, you know, Scott Horton's like a guy who's just constantly, like, if you're going into battle and he's just constantly handing you, like, a bazooka and, a big shield. And I guess those two things don't really go together with war in the same time period. But anyway. The point is that, I mean, he would make this point where, okay, so we've got these FBI, what are essentially entrapments, but, you know, even if you want to be kind to them and just say there's this FBI, you know, criminal investigation work where they work with terrorists. I mean, there's been hundreds of these sting operations since 9/11. And you can actually go through and read them, and God bless Scott Horton because he actually does all this homework, but you can go through every single time. Not like most of the time or 52% of the time, every single time, the way they entrap these guys into radicalizing them is they talk about American foreign policy and what we're doing to their countries. They never sit there and they go like, oh man, doesn't it really piss you off that Janet Jackson's tit popped out in the Super Bowl or the way we have freedom of religion? Doesn't it make you furious how you could open a mosque here and no one's going to do anything to you? It's always about their foreign policy. And of course, as you said with the Ron Paul Giuliani moment, I mean, it's just such basic common sense. As you said, when you kill people's children, they have this tendency to hate you.
Yeah. If somebody, back in 1987, on New Year's Eve in 1987, I have an uncle that owned a Latin nightclub in the Bronx, and somebody was turned away for not being up to dress code. Well, it turned out the guy was a psychopath who was wanted in New York and in Puerto Rico for murder. And he came back in shooting, and one of the bullets caught my uncle in the neck and he died. And one of my other uncles basically hired bad guys to find this guy. And it took 6 months. The cops couldn't find this guy, but they found this guy. And why did this happen? This happened because somebody killed somebody that he loved. And he's like, and he got angry and said, I am not going to stop until the person responsible pays for this. And
yeah.
that is exactly what's happening right now. If I lived in Pakistan and somebody dropped a bomb on my house and I was gone and my whole family was gone, guess what I've just become?
Right.
Because that's in my personality. Revenge is in my personality, and I'm gonna find people who are willing to, I'm gonna team up with people who are willing to hurt whoever is responsible for it. And that's and that may sound simplistic, but that is exactly what is happening right now.
Yeah, it's amazing to me that to me it's like 90% of the time, at least when I argue with people about this, when they say kind of what you were saying before, well, they'd be killing us either way, this isn't blowback, whatever. 90% of the time I have this argument, they literally prove the point that we're making with their argument. So like number one, I mean, I had this clip that went got pretty popular online where I was on SE Cup's show Unfiltered, and I was arguing right after this last not the last one that didn't work out, but the car attack where some Muslim fanatic killed a bunch of people and claimed he was with ISIS. I don't know if they're actually ever established a connection or not, but he And they're sitting there, and I'm making this argument about how U.S. foreign policy has caused all this havoc in this part of the world, how overthrowing secular dictators has led to the rise of ISIS. And they're all like, yeah, yeah, granted. We give you that. That's correct. S.E. Cupp herself even said, I'll grant you everything you just said. That's true. But the argument that everyone at the table throws back at me is like, but we can't just do nothing. I mean, this guy, this terrorist just came here and killed a bunch of our people. We can't just do nothing. And of course, nothing, they mean we need to do something militarily. We need to go kill some of their people. But like, it seems like no one even sits back and appreciates the irony that you're arguing, look, some guy of a different religion just came over here and killed a bunch of our people. We got to go kill some of them. And it's like, exactly. Exactly. That's the point. The point is that that's how other people feel too. And to all these guys, you know, to the more of the Trump maybe wing of the Republican Party, who okay, they've changed the argument a little bit. They don't argue, you know, like George W. Bush and this nonsense of like, you know, Islam is a religion of peace, and if we overthrow Saddam Hussein, they'll become a Jeffersonian republic or something like that. So they don't argue that, but they'll just say, well, look, Muslim culture is so primitive and barbaric and evil. And it's like, okay, well, if their culture is so inferior to ours, and we would be ready to kill people over it, imagine what the fuck they're going to be ready to do. Over it. And Scott Horton, of course, makes this point far more eloquently in his recent book, Fool's Errand. But it's amazing how all of their logic, I mean, it's almost like you could come stand over here and be on my side because you're making my point.
And what's funny is whenever a statist makes, whenever they argue, they always, the points they make, or you can always volley them. It doesn't matter whether it's on, you know, whether it's on monetary policy or, but especially on war, especially this endless war. I mean, when I heard the phrase war on terrorism, the first time I heard it, I mean, I knew there is no way possible that this would ever stop, that this was going to be endless, you know, and my dad used to say, there's a reason why the Pentagon got built. He goes, as soon as the Pentagon was built, they were going to use it. It was going to be used. He goes, they were going to find excuses to use it. It wasn't going to get to the point where there was just so much peace one day that everybody would, you know, no one would show up for work the next day. No, they built this building, this, you know, one of the largest, the second largest building in the world as far as material. I think Ceausescu's palace in Romania is a little bigger, but because they both go all the way down in the ground, but they were going to use this. I mean, if people can make the excuses, oh, well, you know, it was for the Cold War. I'm like, the Cold War was going to be endless. What was it going to be, a nuclear volley? Nobody actually thought that there were, I mean, a lot of people were convinced that there was a nuclear volley, but I guarantee you there wasn't anybody in Washington who was hoping for that. They just knew that this was going to be endless.
Right. Yeah.
And you know, and that's a great thing. You know, when you mentioned Scott Horton, I mean, Scott Horton is my favorite voice in the libertarian movement because God, if you can, you know, it's what Tom Woods said. Tom Woods says he's convinced more conservatives to be anti-war than he has liberals. That's easier because you can show, it's very easy to show the cost of war. And it's very, and if a person is, if their mind is at all open to being changed, I think war is the one thing that will get them over there. Monetary policy, no. Because any conservative walking the street, you know, you can get them to, you can convince them of a monetary policy, but they don't see how the monetary policy of the United States, the way it is, makes possible the wars. And right. Trying to explain that to them, you have to talk to them about war on a moral level. And when you talk about war, it's moral, and then talk about the cost of it. You know, I mean, there are reports right now, unconfirmed, going around that Trump's going to audit the DOD or he's auditing the DOD, and numbers like $29 trillion missing are being thrown around right now. I mean, these are not confirmed numbers, but they are being, you know, I mean, but we've already heard, I mean, the day before 9/11, 2-point-something trillion dollars missing. They said a year ago, $6.5 trillion just walked out of the Pentagon.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, where do you think they ended up? I mean, they ended up at these, in the military industrial complex. I mean, that's who's getting paid. If you're old enough to remember the 80s, why was the government paying $1,500 for a hammer? Because somebody was getting their friend rich.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
It's just a transfer of wealth at our expense.
And it's amazing because it seems like in the mainstream political world, everybody from, the Bernie Sanders wing over to like the Donald Trump wing of the Republican Party, they all seem to kind of get that something's wrong. Economically, you know, whether it's Bernie Sanders, I mean, Trump says make America great again. And a lot of what that's referring to is the fact that, like, you know, we used to have this stable economy where everybody didn't have to live through debt. And like, I mean, my grandfather was a factory worker and my grandmother was a stay at home mom, and he owned his own home and he sent two kids to college and, you know, like played poker on the weekends and they had two cars. And it just seems like it's like, well, okay, where these old jobs are disappearing and where is the new industry? It doesn't seem to be coming as fast, and everybody kind of gets it. And of course, you know, they both have kind of ridiculous solutions for the problems. I think from what I understand, Bernie Sanders is like, well, we can just tax billionaires, even though I mean, just mathematically, it doesn't make any sense. But so Bernie Sanders is like, tax billionaires. And Donald Trump's solution is like, well, I'll just be a better negotiator and go negotiate our way out of this. But this is just such a clear, obvious answer. There are trillions and trillions of dollars just being wasted. Just being absolutely wasted that are, you know, as we all know, are they get this money from robbing it from people.
Well, not to mention, if you look at unfunded liabilities, I mean, I've heard numbers as low as 50 to 60 trillion and numbers as high as 120 to 140 trillion for Social Security, Medicaid, all those things. I mean, these people up in Washington are living in these unbelievable Georgetown brownstones and mansions and everything. And Bernie Madoff went to jail for doing exactly what they're doing.
Yeah. There's a great quote in Bernie Madoff's first interview that he gave in prison. And they asked him something about, they said, well, you know, you ran the biggest Ponzi scheme of all time. And he said, no, I don't. I run the second biggest. They said the biggest Ponzi scheme is the federal government. And I mean, it's absolutely true. And it really is crazy. I was talking to this I'm blanking on his name, but this Democratic congressman. Again, I was on cable news and I just get like, you know, I get two sentences out and then he gets a few sentences back. But I mean, man, if you had one of these guys and like where you could pin him down on a podcast for an hour, he would have absolutely. But they'll say this thing. They'll go, oh, well, Social Security is solvent. It's solvent. And their understanding of solvent, and this is it, which is really, it's quite comical. But so they tax a whole bunch of people for Social Security. They tell you outright that this is money you're putting away for your retirement. They spend all of it, 100% of it. However, now they have an account filled with government IOUs, and they call that solvent because, you know, all the money is there. We've promised we'll print more money in the future to pay you back.
It's funny. I make a metaphor about how I've known people with old money, and they drive 10-year-old cars, and they're not showing any of it off. And then I know people who have quote unquote new money, which just really means in most cases that they're credit rich. They have a good credit score, but they're completely insolvent, and that's it. I mean, the government is just credit rich, and it's not even credit rich. They just have a keyboard where they can type in some numbers, usually 7, 8, or 9 of them, sometimes 10. They put a decimal point after it, and they hit enter, and all of a sudden they're rich again.
Right. Right.
I wish I could do that.
Yeah. It's very interesting. And a lot of it during this, you know, the stuff with this tax bill, that the Republicans are looking to pass to finally get Donald Trump a piece of legislation that he can point to. And it's interesting, some of the conversations that come up around it, because they really do expose kind of the philosophy of both sides, really. But it's quite funny when you'll see all these Democrats who their chief complaint will be like, well, this is going to be more of a tax break for rich people than it will for middle class people. And this is like big corporations in the top 1%. And their concern, and it's so Keynesian in its logic, but their concern is that, well, you know, when rich people get money, they tend to save and invest it. But when these middle class people get the money, they just spend it. As if, like, who could look at America today? Who could look at the state of the current economy in the USA and say, you know, the problem is that we don't have enough spending and we have way too much saving and investing. Like, that's really where we're fucking up, huh?
Well, if spending is a problem, I guess people are looking at it people can learn that just by looking at Washington, D.C.
Right.
And that's what we're taught. We're taught from a young age is, keep up with the Joneses. When I lived in South Florida, South Florida has some considerable wealth and also a lot of people who are credit rich. And it was very easy to spot the credit rich people. I saw them in my neighborhood. They were living in a house that cost maybe $50,000 and they were driving a brand new Corvette.
Right.
And that's basically a metaphor for government as well is, you know, the house is crumbling, but they make everything look good on the outside. But I think that's changing too. I think that, I really believe that the more people are learning about, cryptocurrency,
mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that you have to understand about when people start studying cryptocurrency and exactly what it is, the great thing about it is people who are looking at it as a way to fight the government, to basically bring down the system, they have to study, they understand what fiat is. And there are a lot of speculators right now, which is why you see all they talk about is, you know, what's it worth compared to fiat? Where those of us who see it as a means of just basically toppling the fiat system, no. You know, we want to see people who are actually using it, who are, you know, I've sold some stuff online recently and through certain groups, local groups down here, and I said that I would accept Bitcoin, I would accept Bitcoin Cash, I would accept, you know, send me crypto, you know, we can do this through cryptocurrency. And I mean, I think that's one way to go. I think the more people learn about crypto and the more people listen, you know, to, a great voice for it is Vin Armani. If you listen to his show, the first hour is usually about crypto and the second hour will be about crypto if he has somebody on as a crypto expert. And he talks about this is the way we bring down, you know, this is one of the ways we bring down the system is forget how much it's worth, how much you can sell it for fiat, but start, you know, if you're selling, you know, he's trying to get, you know, he's like, we got to get a page up so that you can sell your book just for crypto. And I'm like,
right.
You know, and that's what he does. He sells vodka and his book and everything, and he only accepts crypto for it. And yeah, he said, he told me, I had him on my podcast and he said a lot of people told him that they made their first crypto purchase so that they could buy his book or buy his vodka or buy, you know, what he, you know, the products that he has. And I think that it's just a tool. I think anybody who's listening to this right now, just start, go read the Satoshi Nakamoto, the original Bitcoin white paper. It's 9 pages. It's one of the most libertarian documents you'll ever read. And read exactly, I mean, there's no, it's not a coincidence that it came out in 2009 after all the bullshit that happened in 2008.
Right.
You know, the whole idea of this wasn't to, oh, how much money can I make off of this in fiat? The whole thing was, how can we subvert fiat? How can we get around it and how can we eventually destroy it?
So. Yeah, because it really is. I mean, the more you study this stuff, it becomes more apparent that monetary policy is right at the center of this whole thing. Like that, the whole beast of statism, I mean, this is where it comes from. This is why, you know, Ron Paul was so important, and it was so obvious that the things that he focused on the most were like these wars and the Fed. And there's really never been another person in the mainstream political world who's made those two things the centerpieces of his campaign. And
even his son, even Rand.
Yeah. Who would look Rand? Yes, look Rand. You know, I was very disappointed, and people who listen to this show know I have not been easy on Rand Paul. But I'll at least give him credit on this, that there were a few moments in the debate when people would ask about income inequality or inequality generally, and he would say, you know, there is a problem with inequality, and a lot of it has to do with the Fed. You know, we live in this, you know, like our political kind of paradigm. You have like this left right thing. And what you'll have is you'll have people on the left who talk about inequality as a moral issue. And then oftentimes, you know, and obviously, I mean, anybody who listens to this show already sees the holes in that and the problem with, you know, like just saying inequality on its head is a problem. Because, of course, you know, some people are more talented. Some people work harder. People are not equal. And it's a ridiculous thing to try to expect them to be. But then you'll have people who get famous on the right side for slapping down this stuff, you know, like Ben Shapiro's and people like that of the world. And they'll make this point. They'll make the point that it's like, oh, no, inequality, you know, there's no, as long as you have freedom, it's fine to have inequality, which me and you would probably agree with. But it seems like nobody is, there's actually a little bit more of a nuanced issue than that that's going on. We do have a real problem with inequality, and it's not being derived through freedom. You know, the truth is that this Federal Reserve scheme is allowing tons of people to get rich off nothing, off producing absolutely nothing in a way that would never happen under market conditions. I mean, you can never be sure exactly what would happen under market conditions, but you can be pretty sure what would never happen. And the idea that there's all these bankers who essentially, I mean, one of the big schemes that these Wall Street banks get rich on is they'll just get money for free from the Federal Reserve and then buy T-bills, or just buy government notes of some sort with it and make 4 or 5% on their interest. They're literally getting paid for moving paper that is that we're forced to accept. Yeah. So there is a real issue there, you know?
Not to mention, yeah, I mean, this is money being created out of thin air. I say all the time, go to any big city, and especially like Atlanta here, the biggest buildings are owned by banks. How do they do that? Because they print money. If you have the ability to print money, you can build. You could build the Tower of Babel. It's just absolutely insane. But also, we have a bunch of people who are getting insanely wealthy, off of war, yeah. And they're not. I mean, these people are not earning. I'm sorry, they're not earning their money. I mean. They've made friends with people in Washington. They've promised them certain things. You know, it's like I go back to Terry McAuliffe. You remember Terry McAuliffe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You see? One of the biggest cheerleaders for ethanol ever. When he retired, he was appointed to the board of 8 companies that are ethanol companies. And come on.
Come on.
And then you have, you know, and then you have all the people who've basically run the FDA who have worked for Monsanto. And then you have, and then the worst of them all is the military industrial complex. Why? Because they're fucking killing people.
Yeah.
I mean, they're killing people all over the world. They're creating, it just appears to me that when they decided there was going to be a quote unquote war on terror, they knew that they were going to have to create enemies all over the world. So they're just bombing the shit out of everybody so that they have an enemy everywhere. I mean, that sounds really simplistic, but damn. I mean, I think anybody in Yemen likes us. You know, anybody in Somalia likes us. Anybody in Libya. I mean, look at Libya. Look at what Libya's become. There's a fucking slave trade in Africa again. I mean, what the fuck, man? This is the 21st century. We're supposed to have flying cars right now. We have fucking war. We have bombs dropping bombs in 7 different countries that can't even feed themselves. What the fuck is going on?
Yeah, it really is just, I mean, it's, and to me, the craziest thing about all of it, and all, of course, all the countries you name there, right? Like you talk about Libya, Yemen, Iraq. These were all countries where we went in and we overthrew secular dictators. And, you know, not like that I'm sitting here praising dictators or anything like that, but we see what happens in this part of the world when we overthrow these secular dictators and a lot of these countries. I mean, Iraq in particular was never really an organic nation to begin with. So once you take the secular dictator out, you just have these warring tribes, essentially. You have the Shiites, the Sunnis, and the Kurds, and they all go right back to war with each other. And then you actually have these neocons, right? You have these guys like Max Boot who are out there, and they look back at the foreign policy, and it's out of a cartoon, and Max Boot's big complaint is that Obama didn't overthrow Assad when we had the chance. Like, he actually wants to have done this to one more of these countries, despite all the, even if you don't agree with us in like a philosophical sense, just as an empiricist, looking at what happens here, and that's what they want, and it really is, I'm sorry, it's hard to take them, at their word that what they really care about is fighting this terrorism, you know, this war on terrorism. Like, his big complaint is not anything to do with Al-Qaeda or ISIS, he's angry that we didn't help them out more by getting rid of Assad when we had the chance.
And this is why Scott Horton is so important. I mean, fool's errand is, I've been telling people this. If you read the first chapter of Fool's Errand and you absorb it, I read it on a flight. If you just read the first chapter, you will understand more about the foreign policy of the United States in the Middle East than probably every talking head on the networks.
Yep.
And I mean, it's just remarkable. I mean, the work he's doing is friggin' phenomenal. I mean, I really didn't understand the intricacies of what was going on, just how the insanity of it. I mean, I understood that it was, oh, this is nuts. I didn't understand exactly how insane it was. Until I started listening to Scott Horton, especially his book. And what's so amazing is, when you go to Amazon and you look at my book and you scroll down and it says other, people who have bought this book also bought, and Fool's Errand's there and Anatomy of the State's there. I couldn't be any prouder. I'm just like, holy crap.
Yeah, well, okay, well, that's a great lead-in to your book, because I want to talk about that a bit. I really do think it's incredible. I really, really enjoyed it. And, of course, Scott Horton wrote the foreword for the book. And, you know, I have a few laws that I believe in. Okay, here's Dave Smith's Law of the World. If Scott Horton recommends a book, you need to read that book. All right? That's a good one. But he wrote the foreword, and the book is, it's Freedom Through Memedom, and it's 31 days, I guess, is the idea.
It's set up to be a 31, like, read one. It's set up for 31 days. There's day one, day two, day three, day four. And, you know, to read one a day and to meditate upon the message that I put out for every day. And I build the message. You know, the first day is obviously going to be taxation, talking about how taxation is theft. And I come at everything, I'm pretty good at economics. You know, I've read Hazlitt. I've read all of Rothbard's books on economics, Road to Serfdom I've read, but my passion is philosophical and moral. So this whole book basically comes from a philosophical and moral standpoint of, yes, taxation is theft. If I can't demand 30% of my neighbor's income, I can't tell somebody else, give somebody else a fancy, you know, a uniform and a title and a badge to go take it. And I just build it from there. And basically my whole goal in writing this was that at the end of it, you would see how illegitimate authority is.
Yeah.
But I also threw in, you know, that's a very easy thing. One thing that scared me, though, was as I was writing it the first few days, I was like, okay, I'm showing everybody how illegitimate authority is. So maybe they're going to go look at anarcho-communism or anarcho-syndicalism or communism or something like that. And I'm like, okay, so I had to take a few days where I attacked, you know, communism, socialism, you know, talked about, there's a chapter in there about the fight for 15 movement. I didn't want people to come away from this like, yeah, I hate the state now. We got to bring down the state. You know, seize the means of production. No, I didn't want that, you know, so.
Yeah, well, you take on all of them in the book. And, of course, obviously, as we're saying, it's through memes. So there'll be like a meme, and then there'll be like a page kind of adding on to it and a description behind it. As I said earlier, I cheated and did not take 31 days to the book. But it really is – it's beautiful – how, you know, like what you just said really, speaks to me, because I think it's something we have in common. Like, I've really tried, you know, I've dove into Rothbard and Mises and like all these great, Hazlitt as well, and all these really great writers. But to me, you know, I'm not coming at this from a point of view of like, well, I want to now be a professional economist, or I want to do, you know, that's above my pay grade. The way I look at things is that it's like, it's kind of like, I mean, I know I use this comparison maybe a little bit too much, but we really are – we're abolitionists. That's what libertarians are, essentially. We believe people should be free, and we want to abolish the institution that enslaves them. And the idea of if you were sitting around, you know, whatever, in 1840 or something like that, and if you were to say like – well, I'm against slavery because production will be increased, and I can kind of break down how production will be increased better if we live in a free world. That's great. And there's a lot of, you know, a lot of great literature to be written about that. But being against slavery is not something you need a PhD in order to be. Any human being with an IQ over like 70 should understand why it's wrong to enslave somebody and to, be able to, you know, the book is like, it's beautifully – it's simple and deep at the same time. And you really found a great way to kind of pull that together. What is it – how did you get so good at creating memes?
Well, I would say probably half of the memes that are in here I created. The other ones are borrowed. You know, they – pretty much when you make a meme, it becomes public domain.
Right.
So, well, here's the thing. I can sit down and I can read Man, Economy, and State. I don't need a study guide. I can sit there and I can read it from cover to cover. But I'm different. I understand. I'm somewhere on the spectrum. I'm autistic enough that I can do that. But most people can't. And especially with young people. Young people seem to love memes, even if they're not political. I mean, the first memes I ever saw were on E-Bomb's World, and this is like 2004, 2005, and they were all comical, you know, or making fun of somebody who did something stupid or something like that. And I always liked them. Around 2010, you know, I'm a big gun guy. I think you probably could see that because in the first five days, I talk about guns and how important they are and how they are. They're everything. I honestly believe that if you don't have a gun, you've submitted yourself to the whims of other people. It's one of the reasons why I can never live in New York City again. I mean, I love New York City. I go to New York City often, but I usually don't last but a couple days, and I feel very naked when I'm there because I don't feel like I can defend myself, even though there's a frigging cop on every corner. What I've seen is in around 2010, there were a lot of memes coming out from libertarians and there were a lot of memes about guns because of Obama.
Right.
And people just glommed onto them, man. It's so huge, you know? So, I mean, like my Twitter page is probably 95%, 97% memes that either, you know, I've made or that I've seen in other places and I share. And with the fact that I know that most people can't sit down and read Human Action, but they can read a meme. And they say a meme comes across, and especially if it's smart, if it's something that's intelligent, and maybe a little snarky, people will, you know, people will read it. It will get, I mean, when I throw, there are some stuff that I throw up there that I get yelled, you know, I have people yelling at me about, and that's fine. You know, I mean, I don't, I agree with Michael Malice. I don't really need to have a conversation with people because I think the further we drift apart, you know, the better we would be because, you know, there's, what are there, 5 or 6 different cultures in this country? And we're trying to keep them all together with one president and one government. I mean, half the people in this country hate the other half, and the half that they hate hates them back.
Yeah.
And then you have all these little factions. So, you know, my purpose in memes is one, just to teach people about freedom, teach people about liberty. And two is to elicit reactions. I mean, and I've had people threaten me. You know, I'm on Facebook too, and I've had when my book first came out, like 5 people from Facebook who absolutely hate me just spammed 1-star reviews. And I mean, they're commies. They admit that they're commies. And I mean, these are people. These are like young kids. I mean, some of them high school age, who say they want me to die. They would kill me if they had the chance. That's what basically we're dealing with now. And one of the great things about one of my purposes for writing this book is I know that young people love memes. I think one of the perfect things for this book is give it to a 17 or 18 year old, especially if they're heading off to college. Try to inoculate them from what they're going to learn there. You know, get them thinking about liberty. You know, give it to somebody who's in college. I mean, I wrote this so that I could change people's minds. And then somebody told me who's a hardcore ANCAP voluntarist. You know, they said they considered it like chicken soup for the anarchist soul. It's like, yeah, I'm an anarchist. I believe all this stuff already, but it's just nice to be able to look at it and read it. And it makes me feel good to know somebody else out there, like, you know, thinks like I do.
Yeah, well, I certainly felt that way reading the book. And I got to agree with you. I mean, I think what's really what's so important about the book is that it is, you know, it's kind of like what we're all searching for, where you'll have, you know, it's like, how are we going to get our numbers up? How are we going to convince more people? Because look, we're never going to get 100% of the population on board with us, but we do need to convince a lot more people and wake a lot more people up. And you look at like the age and the culture that we're living in. And okay, so Ayn Rand woke a lot of people up, through novels. That does not seem to be the culture we're living in today. I just don't think that's what's going to happen, you know? And this is something that I think you can actually, you know, I liked, obviously, Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson, is one that I recommend to like new people a lot or people who just want to like kind of an introduction type thing. And there's a few, Rothbard essays, particularly Anatomy of the State and War, Peace in the State that I always, when people ask me what to start with, but I got to say, I think this is actually the perfect thing. Particularly for young people, if it's like, hey man, here, just start letting some of these ideas creep in a little bit. See, just see some of, and you do it in a way that's funny, which of course I, you know, appreciate, and a way that's just, hey, just showing how full of shit all of these accepted truths are. How full of shit they all are. And I think this is something that could actually work, for today's younger generation. Do you get the feeling, man? Cause I always get this vibe that like my grandfather, he was a factory worker and all his friends were factory workers, but like they knew so much more than these college kids today know. Like if you talk to anyone, I mean, okay, they know a lot in their fucking ridiculous intersectionality language that has absolutely no meaning in real world. And they could probably tell you a lot about like white privilege or something like that. But I mean, literally go grab one of these kids who's like, you know, you see those videos with Jordan Peterson and he's out there with all these people protesting him for, you know, microaggressions against transgender people or whatever the fuck it is. And I just want to like grab one of them, you know, and just be like, hey, so, who was Trotsky? You know, like, who, like, what led to the First World War? Like what? They know nothing, man. Is it? I mean, I'm not wrong about this, right? Do you notice just like I've heard you comment before because I was looking up at some of your stuff, like at the attention span of these young people today. I mean, it's like it's worse than ever.
Well, I think there are a lot of scholars who are coming out now who are doing revisionist work on, you know, the revolution in Russia. There's insane denial of like Holodomor in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, my maternal grandmother is Ukrainian and she's the only one who was left from her family from that. And well, her mother made it out, but everybody else died. And I had somebody on Twitter, I mean, like 3 weeks ago tell me, no, that never happened. It's like, well, I mean, that's my family, you know, that's my family. I mean, I know it happened. You know, but what you were saying about people who, you know, my mother's side of the family were mostly coal miners from Pennsylvania. And they were well read. And I've even heard Tom Woods talk about how his dad wasn't educated, but he educated himself. And I'm the same way. I mean, I have almost enough credits to graduate college, but at this point I'm not worried about that. But basically everything that I know that I consider to be important for my life, I learned on my own. And I think that's part of the problem, is that we do have a majority of the young kids who would have the motivation to go and read books and really study are being thrown into this system that's run by commies.
Yeah.
So that's what they hear. They accept it as the truth. I mean, I had somebody who was was recommending all these books and articles to me about how Che Guevara never killed an innocent person. And I'm like, he was in fucking war. Every war, innocent people die, you scumbag. I mean, how do you not know this? You know, so there's all this revisionist history going on. And, man, we got to get, you know, luckily from what I've heard is that people say that the generation that's growing up now is a lot of them are rejecting this left-wing bullshit, you know, this leftist progressive, I mean, even communists going all the way up to Antifa. If you look at, you know, if you look at a lot of the sites that people, you know, would call the alt-right or things like that, a lot of them are really, you know, they're very young and they're rejecting it. Now, I think they do what most people tend to do. If they're rejecting one thing, they tend to go all the way in the other direction, you know, basically creating horseshoe theory.
Right.
People on the far left and the far right are really not that far apart. Just remove a couple things. But yeah, man, we gotta figure out a way to get to the young people. And that's really, you know, I mean, I'm not trying to hawk. I mean, yeah, I'm here to hawk a book, but goddamn, man, it's, they need to hear this message. No one is hearing this message, especially, you know, after 2012, you know, when after the 2012 election and everything, this message basically disappeared. And, you know, people like Stefan Molyneux continued it and were great voices for it, very smart. But even that, you know, he's abandoned it. And it's just like, my whole thing about how I have this theory that the reason people are going to the culture war, fighting the culture war, instead of fighting who's the real enemy, the state, I mean, and the state is the one who gives all the power to these culture warriors, you know, to these leftists, insane leftists who are against freedom of speech, and I think the reason why people like Molyneux and other people abandoned it and have basically become statists again is because they don't feel like they can win a fight with the state, but they feel like they can win the culture war.
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
So, I mean, you know, because think about it. I mean, how long has he been fighting? How long was he fighting the state before he made the turn? I mean, that gets it can get tiresome for people after a while. I mean, even Rothbard at the end of his life pretty much went full paleo. So, I mean, that's got to be brutal when you're 10, 15, 20 years in and you're not seeing any progress, but oh, you know, I can take to the streets and, you know, pick up a shield and put on a mask and a stick and I can go fight these crazy leftists.
Right. You know, I got to say, for me, since I've been in this game, the libertarian space, and, you know, it's what my interest was first sparked in 2007 by Ron Paul, and there's been nothing more heartbreaking for me than that stuff that you're talking about. And it's not, you know, I mean, it's been interesting seeing the left wing lose their mind, kind of entertaining at times, but it was just heartbreaking to me that I really felt like, particularly in 2012 in the Ron Paul campaign, where I was like, man, we're really building something here. Like, even if it's not the majority, we got this army of young people and they're not going back, you know, like they've seen the truth. They're not going to be able to be blinded again. And maybe it's just my own bias, but I can forgive Rothbard. Because I understand how hopeless it seemed at the time for him.
Right.
But after we had the Ron Paul moment, I just can't believe that anyone would want to abandon that and you know, try to fight the culture war. I mean, look, like I'll call out the cultural problems too. I think culture is very important and we should talk about these things. But I guess Trump getting in really kind of opened my eyes to that too. Like, if we're just bashing the lefty culture and willing to accept whatever it is that defeats it, we're going to end up with something that's praise the military, praise the cops, which is a far more dangerous culture. Because at the end of the day, these left-wing kids are all a bunch of fucking pussies. I mean, none of them have guns. None of them can get into an actual fist fight. And on this other side, you've got a real formidable opponent. And the stuff you're talking about with Stephen Molyneux and guys like that, I mean, man, it's just so hard for me to reconcile, you know, some of the stuff that I've heard out of that guy's mouth. I mean, just who broke down anarcho-capitalism better than that guy? And to see this turn is really surprising to me. Now, when I got a lot of hate and I got a lot of shit when the alt-right movement was building up, say from the kind of like the build of it up until the Charlottesville thing. And, you know, I had Richard Spencer on the show. I had Christopher Cantwell on the show and I figured like, yeah, let's take these guys on. Let's hear their ideas. Let them speak for themselves. Cause I do think if you believe you have the truth on your side, there, you know, freedom of speech is kind of in your interest as you talk about in the book. And I mean, look, at the end of the day, I kind of felt like what you were saying before. I mean, look, how useful is it for me to say Nazis are bad? Everybody in our freaking culture knows that Nazis are bad. As Bob Murphy put it in one of his pieces, the philosophical question we have in our culture is, if you could go back in time, would you murder baby Hitler? Like, that's the range of how bad we think Nazis are. But the crimes of the commies have been completely whitewashed. Most people don't even know about them. And you got like open Marxist professors, in universities, pretty much every university across the country. But it really just feels so tragic to me because what you're talking about, all these people who are rejecting this Antifa and this radical leftism crap, if there's a Ron Paul movement going on, I think that's a great chance to be a magnet to draw them in. If there is a fucking Charlottesville Christopher Cantwell movement going on, there's no chance. There's literally no chance. It's a non-starter.
Yeah. It's amazing to me, maybe because of who I am, how I was, you know, how I'm made, that I just want freedom. You know, I want to be free. I was recently in, my wife and I went to Iceland for vacation and I got back and people were like, so, you know, what was it like? What was amazing? I said, I didn't see one fucking cop. That was the first thing out of my mouth. It was like my hugest takeaway from the whole thing was, I never saw a cop for 10 days in a country that is a heavy tourist area, that's a heavy tourist country. I was in a country for 10 days and never saw a cop. Not even at the airport. But what was funny was when we were taxiing out in the plane, I saw U.S. planes there, Air Force planes there, because they have a military base there. But, and that's my whole thing is how can people not be desirous of freedom and understand what freedom is? I mean, freedom, liberty, you know, freedom's almost become a word that's just meaningless. Because so many people use the word freedom that don't really mean it. I like the word liberty because it's not a word that's used a whole lot. But to me, liberty is just basically being able to live out my life without any interference. How do these people not want that? How does a young communist look at that system and think that they're going to be free in it? I can only think that they just don't desire it. How can somebody on the alt-right look at Richard Spencer, who, you know, was advocating for net neutrality, who's basically a socialist, and not want to be free, not realizing that they're not going to be free in that system? I mean, I think, we got to go. It's like the Ron Paul movement. We got to go after the young people. We just can't stop. You know, there has to be a generation that rises up that really understands liberty. So, I mean, that's why I do what I do on Twitter. And I do not have the time to be on Twitter doing what I do on a daily basis, but I make time for it because this is really, really important. Now, I want to see liberty in my lifetime. And it's going to be a fight, and it's going to be a lot of hard work.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. But, again, like there's, you know, nothing is, predetermined. At least I don't believe it is. And if we're going to get there, it's because people are going to get us there. So I agree with you that we have to fight that fight and do everything we can. But you see, I mean, to me, it's like the Trump moment almost proves it. It's like, if you want to give up on this thing and just go with the, well, we got to take over the state and use it to bash our enemies. It's really quite hilarious because during the campaign, you know, especially with Rand Paul, you know, having the lackluster performance that he did, it all the alt-right guys were kind of pointing and laughing at us libertarians and saying, aha, you know, keep preaching about your non-aggression principle or whatever. Look what that got you. It got you nothing. Now we're actually going to win because we went with a strong man. And I'm looking around at these alt-right guys as Donald Trump goes around, like all these guys who are like so, you know, they hate Jews and they hate Muslim culture. And you watch Donald Trump, he's dropping off $100 billion and weapons to the Saudis. He's moving the recognizing the Israeli capital in Jerusalem. And you're like, well, yeah, look, what a wonderful victory you guys had. And then, of course, all the stuff we care about, like government spending is going up. War casualties are going up. Defense spending is going up. I mean, by every metric, it's a disaster. So this is the problem. It's like what Scott Horton always says about the wars over there. It's like winning is losing. So congratulations, you won. And now we're bigger losers.
Yeah, I guess if for 2 years, you know, a year and a half, you were shaking your ass so hard for Donald Trump, you know, when he gets in there and he, you know, within a couple months is dropping bombs on Syria, and then he's going and, you know, doing the orb, that crazy orb thing in Saudi Arabia, and then he's going and kissing the wall in Israel. I mean, I guess it's, you know, if you put that much effort into it, I mean, but I'm a different kind of person. You know, I mean, I see people, you know, we've talked about like Stefan Molyneux. I mean, I'm not going to stay with him when he changes his tune. I'm just going to abandon it immediately, say, I think he's wrong. I hope he comes back. But I can't have anything to do with them. You know, and then you have, there were like tons of ANCAPs that became what I call bordertarians. They right. immediately wanted to become, you know, they immediately, oh, we need a border. And then they started coming up with this crazy argument about how, we've been taxed and our taxes paid for public land. So the government is now a trustee of that public land for us. And these people who are coming in late, they're interlopers and everything. I'm like, wait a minute. I thought taxation is theft.
Right.
I thought the state is not to be trusted. Yet you're saying that they're trustees. I mean, I actually had someone say, oh, this is my plan. We have to tear down the left and destroy the left culture. And then now comes the hard part. We are going to convince the conservatives to be conservative again. I'm like, you call yourself an ANCAP voluntarist? Are you fucking listening to yourself?
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the big things that they would, that they'll say is they'll go like, okay, so those people you're talking about, the ANCAPs who become like border hawks. So they'll say, okay, so we'll all kind of agree. Ideally, there's no government controlled borders and there's no welfare state. And they'll say like, well, if we could dismantle the welfare state, then that'd be fine. But that's hopeless. So we got to focus on these borders. But then you'll see, I mean, Donald Trump just attempting to get a travel ban on countries we're at war with. You have people protesting in the streets, calling him a Nazi. It gets more resistance than ever. I'm like, what's the actual evidence that this is going to be more achievable than dismantling the welfare state? Oh, yeah. And by the way, dismantling the welfare state is consistent with libertarianism, and government-controlled borders are not. So how did we switch our focus?
And I love the argument of and then all of a sudden they became really moral. It's like, well, you know, drugs and they start talking down about homosexuality and everything. And I'm like, what the fuck is going on here? It's like that's nothing a libertarian should care about. And they're like, well, you know, if we build the wall, it'll stop the flow of drugs. I'm like, the wall's going to stop the CIA? what are you talking about? Gary Webb. Google Gary Webb.
Right.
I mean, come on. And now you're putting down homosexuality. Why? Because Hoppe's gone paleo now? Come on. Come on, guys. Yeah, I mean, Read through it.
Yeah, and for me, it's like the idea that that you would say we all agree on like the ideal society and where we want to go, and then we're talking about strategy, and you're telling me that your strategy is to embrace the most toxic people, the most toxic people in our society who are literally, I mean, just embrace the worst values, the most anti freedom values imaginable. I mean, look, the thing that I guess the area where I'm sympathetic to some of the younger people who have gone into an alt-right-ish direction is that I will say I am, it, you know, it really is outrageous, the anti-white bigotry of these leftist Marxists in college campuses and universities. I mean, it's really insane. It's like something out of a cartoon of how you would think, you know, like how I was taught that like a black person would be treated. And I don't mean to equate the struggle, okay? I'm not saying like white people at a college campus have it as bad as black people under Jim Crow or something like that. But I mean, rhetorically, the way they talk to some of them. I mean, my brother, I have a much younger brother, and he's a writer. And he would tell me about, like, when he's in his writing classes, he just graduated college a couple years ago. And he would tell me about when he's in his writing classes, and he'd have some, like, creative writing piece, and they'd go around and dissect his white privilege. And what, you know, like, what's wrong with him? Because he's white, he can't, you know, have a character that might be aggressive, or have a character that like, you know, is sexist or something like that. And look, I do understand to some degree that young people and young men particularly, they want to have an identity that they can be proud of. And I think nobody offered them that until they saw these guys over there who were saying like, no, you're great for being white. And they're basically playing the exact same identity politics game that everybody around them in their colleges. So it's like, why not play that game and come over here? So I guess like I have a little bit of sympathy toward that. But my God, I mean, the idea of embracing an authoritarian government on racial that kind of works based off race. I mean, Jesus Christ, crack a history book, man. It doesn't work out good for anybody, and it doesn't work out good for your race either.
But, yeah, I mean, I've had the white privilege thing thrown at me, and then of course I always volley right back. My father is Spanish, you know, 100%. So, you know, I'm half Spanish. So, what about that? And they're always, and immediately what they say is, well, that really doesn't mean anything because look at the way you're acting and look at what you believe.
Right.
I mean, and you can see it. You could see it with, you know, black libertarians, someone like Eric Chalai or something. I mean, they don't, you know, he's not black now because of what he believes. And it's absolute insanity. And I agree with you. If I was younger, if I wasn't as educated as I am now, maybe if I wasn't such a liberty hawk. Yeah, you know, just the attitude that they have towards white people, just wanting to shut them up. You know, and and men too. I mean, when you get on Twitter and you start reading some of the things that these insane, insane women and their cucks talk about men is just, I mean, you know, whenever a guy does it, I'm just like, dude, she's not going to fuck you. Okay. So stop. You're not going to get laid doing this. Because they're still going to want real men like us, you know. So cut that bullshit out, and you know, stop. But yeah, I mean, Twitter's insane, man. You'll see like somebody talk about how, you know, white men need to be castrated, and then it's retweeted like 27,000 times. It's like, I can genuinely understand where they're coming from, except. My whole strategy against those people is to just ridicule.
Right.
It's to ridicule, and especially, you know, especially if you have any kind of sense of humor, and you can be funny. Yeah, I did. There was I'm not going to mention his name because I don't want to give him any. I don't want to give him any publicity. But it's a guy on who's a contributor on CNN. He's also a professor in New York, and he came out and he did. I don't know if you remember earlier this year, there was a bunch of people who were virtue signaling through their kids. You know, my four-year-old saw a rally on TV and asked if Jews were going to be incinerated again. And they were doing all these things. And this guy put one out saying that his 9-year-old daughter was watching the Charlottesville thing and looked at him and said, is there going to be another Holocaust? And I tweeted back at him, I'll take shit that didn't happen for 500, Alex. And it got like 2,000, you know, likes and 1,000 retweets. And he actually like contacted me because he wanted to talk about it. And I actually did a podcast with him and we talked all this shit over. That I've since deleted. It's the only podcast I've ever done out of 68 podcasts that I've deleted because I came to decide I don't want to give this guy any fucking, I don't want to give him any publicity.
And he was maintaining
that. Well, you know, my daughter goes to yeshiva and, you know, when they're 8, they start learning, you know, they start learning about Shoah and everything. And I'm just like, I still don't fucking believe you. You know, it's like, I'm sorry. Yeah. And there was a bunch of tweets like that, man. It was like all these people who are virtue signaling through their kids and the responses were just, oh, it was some of the best humor out there, man. If you had seen it, you would have loved them. They were funny as shit.
I mean, it's been said by like a bunch of different people. I remember one time, particularly in Jordan Peterson, in one of these like clips that's gone viral, where he's arguing with a bunch of like transgender activists, and he said something. He goes like, "Man, you know, if you keep pushing things like this, you are not gonna like the movement that's gonna rise up on the right to counter you guys here." And then of course they all go, "Oh, he's threatening us. He's threatening, you know," and it's like, no, he's not threatening you. He's giving you a warning informed by history. And, you know, I gotta say, it's like something that I kind of woke up to, like when I first started, the alt-right thing first started happening, it was kind of like, oh, well, you know, at the end of the day, what power do they really have? You know, it's not like they have tenured professors. It's not like they control the media and the deep state and the Hollywood and the entire culture.
They have guns.
Yes. You know, this is what I really started. This is what I started to realize. And I got to say again, the great Scott Horton was somebody who really set me straight on this. But it's like, look, man, those cucks that you're talking about who are like, oh yeah, I'm a feminist ally and I'm worried about microaggressions too and transgender rights, and they may call you names on Twitter or something like that, but they are pussies, man. They don't have guns and they can't win a fist fight against anyone. And what they are inspiring on the other side to rise up are not pussies, man. They are not. I mean, I'm convinced, I talked about this a few podcasts ago, but I'm convinced a big part of the reason why Trump won and why there was no shenanigans and no funny business, even though they flirted it around, the reason why, like, the CIA didn't move in, why the RNC didn't change the rules and all this, is that Trump has courted the toughest motherfuckers in America. I mean, I'm not saying he has all of them, but Trump's base are not these pussies. They're like men with big barrel chests. It's the cops. It's military. It's tough fucking guys. And these lefties, man, you almost want to like warn them. It's like you want to like offer them a draw for their own sake. Like, guys, you want a revolution that you will get smashed under. You will get smashed under it. And honestly, the rest of us will too, because that's actually a threat to us.
Yeah.
You know, like, we can handle these college lefties. These other guys are going to be a problem.
Yeah. It's, these, you know, I think anybody who reads this book and, who's listened to my last five podcasts knows I'm not a friend of the police, even though, like, just about every one of my friends in friggin' New York is NYPD or retired NYPD, which is just remarkable. They know it's amazing that they still, like, when I go up there, they want to hang out because of some of the shit that I say and some of the stuff I post on Facebook. But, yeah, I mean, they really don't understand. They really don't understand what they're getting into. Now, if they want to take on authority, we know they're going to lose. But it's like you said, these police, they will get out of hand and they will just start shooting anybody. I mean, they will, you know, it's like you said, it's like Jordan Peterson said, you don't know what you're starting. If it really starts coming out, I mean, we've seen violence, okay? You know, we've seen stuff in San Francisco, Seattle, you know, an Antifa guy got shot in the stomach in Seattle. You know, you normally don't see them go to places where guns are actually legal and do anything. Like, they, Richard Spencer was talking, was doing a talk at Auburn University down here, and Atlanta Antifa went over there. Notice you didn't hear a peep about that. Because, right. I mean, in Alabama, everybody has three guns, and they carry, one is on them and two are in their truck. Okay? So, the problem I have with what they're, it's like you said, the problem I have with what they're doing is if there's going to be collateral damage. And, really, if it comes down to it where there's an authority, where the police and the military get authoritarian, people, you know, you just might have to side with some people you don't want to side with to fight against it. And yeah. I don't want to do that. You know, I mean, I have all the guns and ammo I could ever need for pretty much the rest of my life. I'd never want to use them for anything other than going out and having fun shooting at paper and cans and, you know, God forbid, defense. But I never want to use it for offense. And what they're pushing, it could actually get to that.
Yeah, and it's like a big part of the problem. Boom. Is that these guys, right, like these guys, the campus lefties, they really know nothing about history. That was one of the points I was trying to make before, and they know nothing about it. And it really is, worthwhile to inform yourself at least to some degree on history. And if you learn anything about history, what you'll learn right away is that we really shouldn't take what we have for granted. And that we live at an incredibly high standard of life right now. And you know, it's like, yeah, man, things can go bad really quickly. And there's a lot of trends that are going on right now that are really, really bad trends. And I'll tell you, it's almost like weirdly, because I, you know, I'm like an anarchist capitalist over here, and it's almost like turned me into a, like in some of these conversations, I'll feel like a moderate. Yeah, I was talking to someone the other day who was saying, like, they support Trump and they still support Trump because, like, burn it all down. Let's just burn it all down. And you're like, really? Really? That's what you want to do? You don't want, like, a peaceful transition into something? You want to burn it all down? What do you think the odds are that we build up a libertarian society after burning it all down? You know? Like, that's not how it usually works in history. I mean, we don't want it. Look, I agree with you. I said, I look at all the different cultures we have, and I think it's more obvious than now. Like, what the fuck is the point of us being one country? There seems to be no point whatsoever except to have a federal government that is able to leverage their tax cattle to do more horrific shit than any other government is doing right now, at least externally. Okay, so I'm down for that. But, man, do you really want it to come to some type of bloody civil war confrontation? I mean, all of us have a lot to lose, man.
Yeah, it's we talk about how much we want true liberty, and I've heard you talk about before that. You know, I've been to a third world country, what people would consider a third world country, and you know, we really got to be happy for what we have. I mean, of course it could be better, but what they're advocating for, I mean, will take us into no different than 1989 Romania kind of revolution, you know, where people are fighting, where people are basically fighting in the streets of Bucharest. And, you know, I don't really think, I mean, so many of the people who are calling for revolution, the commies and everything, you know, who are calling themselves commies, they're artists. You know, they're all like in the arts, and you know, they think that they're going to get this, you know, they're going to get this communist revolution going, and you know, they're going to be. I saw one person say, "Oh, you know, I'm an artist. I'll design the uniforms for our voluntary military." I'm like, you realize you're all going to be fucking artists. Somebody's going to have to scrub toilets,
right?
You know, and you realize you're not going to be able to get out of it. You're going to have to do this. But if you came over to my way, you could still be a friggin' commie in our structure, in our framework. You could, as long as it's voluntary, as long as everybody who's doing it is voluntary, that's fine. But I could never exist. You know, I've asked them flat out. I said, what would someone like me, you know, what would happen to someone like me if you got your society? And immediately they'd say gulag. Or bullet.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing how quick they are. In some weird, perverse way, I almost appreciate the honesty.
Yeah.
Where people will at least acknowledge that. It's really funny, you know, it's like I've heard some of the radical feminists where they'll say things, you know, and this is like kind of applies to the whole left-wing thinking in general, but they'll say these things where they'll go, you know, society would be better off if we reduced the population of men down to only 100,000, or we reduced the population of men only down to 5%. And it's like, well, in order to do that, you're going to need to fight a war. And in order to fight a war, you're going to need fucking men. Cause yeah. That's what it takes to fight war. And they just have no clue about this shit.
Well, not to mention, who do they sound like?
Yeah.
I mean, be consistent, you know, be consistent, people. Who do you sound like? You know, just replace men with Jews.
Yeah.
Who do you sound like? Come on. This isn't hard. More than any other time, man. With what's going on, with everything that's going on, that the message of real liberty, of voluntarism, you know, I consider myself more a voluntarist than I do an ANCAP, just because, you know, like I said, I'm more of a moralist and a philosopher, and I think that that's the path. And I also believe that a voluntarist should be able to operate as they could within a society, as such as we have right now. I mean, if somebody says, look, I just want to be left alone to do what to live my life, to be productive, you know, why can't you leave me alone? Oh, you sign, because I allegedly signed some phony social contract because I was born on a patch of land in one place? How about just leave me alone?
Yeah.
And how hard is that, man? I mean, that's, isn't that the whole message? Leave me alone? It's like, yeah, it's three words.
No, look, I'm with you completely. And I guess in the face of all this craziness, I mean, what we got to hope for, right, is I remember Daniel McAdams said this to me once about Ron Paul. And he said, no matter how crazy things get or how turbulent, you know, it all seems, what you do is you stick to the message and you grasp onto the non-aggression principle and you hold on to it for dear life. And what we got to do is just understand that, like, you know, things are a little bit darker right now than they were in, say, 2012, but things are, they've been way worse in the past, and we've had kind of libertarian moments rise up from that. I think what we gotta do is stay consistent, be the ones who are arguing for something that's actually morally just and that is actually consistent and true, and, you know, hopefully, I do think to some degree after that Charlottesville thing, I think the alt-right thing did die down a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think when people see something like that, they get turned off to it. I think the Antifa thing has died down a little bit because people get turned off to a lot of that. So what we gotta do is we gotta have something that's a magnet that we can actually draw more people into. And, I gotta say, I think freedom through memedom is a really great tool to try to help with that. So we got to wrap up here, but I just want to mention again, the podcast is Free Man Beyond the Wall. And of course, as I said, the book, which is fantastic and I highly recommend, is Freedom Through Memedom. Mr. Rader, thank you very much for coming on the show. We got to do this again. I really enjoyed it.
Man, I love your show. I told you before we went on, I love Skanks. I love Legion of Skanks. Keep up the good work, man. Keep
All right. Thanks so much. Thanks so much, brother. I appreciate it. We'll do this again, as I said. All right, guys, thank you very much for listening. What a fun episode that was. And I will be back with a brand new episode on Friday. We also will have a bonus episode coming out this week. I haven't forgotten about that. Promise you I'll get that up real soon. Thanks for listening, everybody. Peace.
Well, everyone, I want to thank you for tuning in and listening to that interview that I did with Dave Smith. I was very fortunate to be on his show. And Dave's just a great guy. If you're not listening to every episode of Part of the Problem, you're missing out. So add that to your playlist. And that's usually one that most times I can watch it live. He does it Mondays and Friday nights at 6 o'clock live. If not, as soon as it's released, I check it out because he's talking about current events. He's making great points and he's just destroying basically every argument out there for statism, for interventionist foreign policy. And Dave's just a great guy. So I want to remind you about the book, The Kids Are Not All Right, A Meme-Enhanced Primer on Encroaching Marxism in the West. Like I said, Dave did the foreword for it. It's a great foreword. He gets deep into the subject of the book. So you should look forward to reading what Dave had to say. So it's on Amazon. Search Mance Rader. You'll see both of my books there. It's available. I got it out in Kindle the same day it was released in paperback because last time it took a couple weeks and people wanted Kindle and I immediately saw people just getting Kindle versions of it right away. And like I said, you know, if you have Kindle, you can download it in a couple seconds. So I'll be coming back at you in the middle of the week with another podcast, maybe even sooner. See if we can get that James Bovard up even sooner. And that's about it. So take care. I'll talk to you in the middle of the week. Tune in to Dave Smith's Part of the Problem, 6 p.m. Eastern Time on Gas Digital. It's going to be a lot of fun, so have a great week. Bye.